The Battle for United Flight 93. At 8:42, United Airlines Flight 93 took off from Newark, New Jersey, Liberty International Airport, bound for San Francisco. The aircraft was piloted by Captain Jason Dahl and First Officer Leroy Homer, and there were 5 flight attendants. 37 passengers, including the hijackers, boarded the plane. Scheduled to depart the gate at 8 o'clock, the Boeing 757's takeoff was delayed because of the airport's typically heavy morning traffic. The hijackers had planned to take flights scheduled to depart at 7:45, American 11, 8 o'clock, United 175 and United 93, and 8:10, American 77. 3 of the flights had actually taken off within 10 to 15 minutes of their planned departure times. United 93 would ordinarily have taken off about 15 minutes after pulling away from the gate. When it left the ground at 8:42, the flight was running more than 25 minutes late. As United 93 left Newark, the flight's crew members were unaware of the hijacking of American 11. Around 9, the FAA, American, and United were facing the staggering realization of apparent multiple hijackings. At 9:03, they would see another aircraft strike the World Trade Center. Crisis managers at the FAA and the airlines did not yet act to warn other aircraft. At the same time, Boston Center realized that a message transmitted just before 8:25 by the hijacker pilot of American 11 included the phrase, "We have some planes."
"We have some planes. Just stay quiet and it'll be okay. We're returning to the airport."
No one at the FAA or the airlines that day had ever dealt with multiple hijackings. Such a plot had not been carried out anywhere in the world in more than 30 years, and never in the United States. As news of the hijackings filtered through the FAA and the airlines, it does not seem to have occurred to their leadership that they needed to alert other aircraft in the air that they too might be at risk. United 175 was hijacked between 8:42 and 8:46, and awareness of that hijacking began to spread after 8:51. American 77 was hijacked between 8:51 and 8:54. By 9 o'clock, FAA and airline officials began to comprehend that attackers were going after multiple aircraft. American Airlines' nationwide ground stop between 9:05 and 9:10 was followed by a United Airlines ground stop. FAA controllers at Boston Center, which had tracked the first 2 hijackings, requested at 9:07 that Herndon Command Center get messages to airborne aircraft to increase security for the cockpit. There is no evidence that Herndon took such action. Boston Center immediately began speculating about other aircraft that might be in danger, leading them to worry about a transcontinental flight, Delta 1989, that in fact was not hijacked. At 9:19, the FAA's New England Regional Office called Herndon and asked that Cleveland Center advise Delta 1989 to use extra cockpit security. Several FAA air traffic control officials told us it was the air carrier's responsibility to notify their planes of security problems. One senior FAA air traffic control manager said that it was simply not the FAA's place to order the airlines what to tell their pilots. "We believe such statements do not reflect an adequate appreciation of the FAA's responsibility for the safety and security of civil aviation." The airlines bore responsibility, too. They were facing an escalating number of conflicting and, for the most part, erroneous reports about other flights, as well as a continuing lack of vital information from the FAA about the hijacked flights. We found no evidence, however, that American Airlines sent any cockpit warnings to its aircraft on 9/11. United's first decisive action to notify its airborne aircraft to take defensive action did not come until 9:19, when a United flight dispatcher, Ed Ballinger, took the initiative to begin transmitting warnings to his 16 transcontinental flights. Beware any cockpit intrusion. 2AC hit World Trade Center. One of the flights that received the warnings was United 93. Because Ballinger was still responsible for his other flights as well as Flight 175, his warning message was not transmitted to Flight 93 until 9:23. By all accounts, the first 46 minutes of Flight 93's cross-country trip proceeded routinely. Radio communications from the plane were normal. Heading, speed, and altitude ran according to plan. At 9:24, Ballinger's warning to United 93 was received in the cockpit. Within 2 minutes, at 9:26, the pilot, Jason Dahl, responded with a note of puzzlement. Ed, confirm latest message, please. Jason. The hijackers attacked at 9:28. While traveling 35,000 feet above eastern Ohio, United 93 suddenly dropped 700 feet. 11 seconds into the descent, the FAA's Air Traffic Control Center in Cleveland received the first of two radio transmissions from the aircraft. During the first broadcast, the captain or first officer could be heard declaring Mayday amid the sounds of a physical struggle in the cockpit. The second radio transmission, 35 seconds later, indicated that the flight was continuing. The captain or first officer could be heard shouting, "Hey, get out of here! Get out of here! Get out of here!" On the morning of 9/11, there were only 37 passengers on United 93, 33 in addition to the four hijackers. This was below the norm for Tuesday mornings during the summer of 2001, but there is no evidence that the hijackers manipulated passenger levels or purchased additional seats to facilitate their operation. The terrorists who hijacked three other commercial flights on 9/11 operated in five-man teams. They initiated their cockpit takeover within 30 minutes of takeoff. On Flight 93, however, the takeover took place 46 minutes after takeoff, and there were only four hijackers. The operative likely intended to round out the team for this flight, Mohammed Al-Qahtani, had been refused entry by a suspicious immigration inspector at Florida's Orlando International Airport in August. Because several passengers on United 93 described three hijackers on the plane, not four, some have wondered whether one of the hijackers had been able to use the cockpit jump seat from the outset of the flight. FAA rules allow use of this seat by documented and approved individuals, usually air carrier or FAA personnel. We have found no evidence indicating that one of the hijackers, or anyone else, sat there on this flight. All the hijackers had assigned seats in first class, and they seem to have used them. We believe it is more likely that Jarrah, the crucial pilot-trained member of their team, remained seated and inconspicuous until after the cockpit was seized. And once inside, he would not have been visible to the passengers. At 9:32, a hijacker, probably Jarrah, made or attempted to make the following announcement to the passengers of Flight 93. "Ladies and gentlemen, here the captain. Please sit down, keep remaining sitting. We have a bomb on board. So, sit." The flight data recorder, also recovered, indicates that Jarrah then instructed the plane's autopilot to turn the aircraft around and head east. The cockpit voice recorder data indicate that a woman, most likely a flight attendant, was being held captive in the cockpit. She struggled with one of the hijackers, who killed or otherwise silenced her. Shortly thereafter, the passengers and flight crew began a series of calls from GTE airphones and cellular phones. These calls between family, friends, and colleagues took place until the end of the flight, and provided those on the ground with first-hand accounts. They enabled the passengers to gain critical information, including the news that two aircraft had slammed into the World Trade Center. At 9:39, the FAA's Cleveland Air Route Traffic Control Center overheard a second announcement indicating that there was a bomb on board, that the plane was returning to the airport, and that they should remain seated. While it apparently was not heard by the passengers, this announcement, like those on Flight 11 and Flight 77, was intended to deceive them. Jarrah, like Atta earlier, may have inadvertently broadcast the message because he did not know how to operate the radio and the intercom. To our knowledge, none of them had ever flown an actual airliner before. At least two callers from the flight reported that the hijackers knew that passengers were making calls, but did not seem to care. It is quite possible Jarrah knew of the success of the assault on the World Trade Center. He could have learned of this from messages being sent by United Airlines to the cockpits of its transcontinental flights, including Flight 93, warning of cockpit intrusion and telling of the New York attacks. But even without them, he would certainly have understood that the attacks on the World Trade Center would already have unfolded, given Flight 93's tardy departure from Newark. If Jarrah did not know that the passengers were making calls, it might not have occurred to him that they were certain to learn what had happened in New York, thereby defeating his attempts at deception. At least 10 passengers and 2 crew members shared vital information with family, friends, colleagues, or others on the ground. All understood the plane had been hijacked. They said the hijackers wielded knives and claimed to have a bomb. The hijackers were wearing red bandanas, and they forced the passengers to the back of the aircraft. Callers reported that a passenger had been stabbed and that 2 people were lying on the floor of the cabin, injured or dead, possibly the captain and first officer. One caller reported that a flight attendant had been killed. One of the callers from United 93 also reported that he thought the hijackers might possess a gun, but none of the other callers reported the presence of a firearm. One recipient of a call from the aircraft recounted specifically asking her caller whether the hijackers had guns. The passenger replied that he did not see one. No evidence of firearms or of their identifiable remains was found at the aircraft's crash site, and the cockpit voice recorder gives no indication of a gun being fired or mentioned at any time. We believe that if the hijackers had possessed a gun, they would have used it in the flight's last minutes as the passengers fought back. Passengers on 3 flights reported the hijackers' claim of having a bomb. The FBI told us they found no trace of explosives at the crash sites. One of the passengers who mentioned a bomb expressed his belief that it was not real. Lacking any evidence that the hijackers attempted to smuggle such illegal items past the security screening checkpoints, we believe the bombs were probably fake. During at least 5 of the passengers' phone calls, information was shared about the attacks that had occurred earlier that morning at the World Trade Center. 5 calls described the intent of passengers and surviving crew members to revolt against the hijackers. According to one call, they voted on whether to rush the terrorists in an attempt to retake the plane. They decided and acted. At 9:57, the passenger assault began. Several passengers had terminated phone calls with loved ones in order to join the revolt. One of the callers ended her message as follows. Everyone's running up to first class. I've got to go. Bye. The cockpit voice recorder captured the sounds of the passenger assault, muffled by the intervening cockpit door. Some family members who listened to the recording report that they can hear the voice of a loved one among the din. We cannot identify whose voices can be heard, but the assault was sustained. In response, Jarrah immediately began to roll the airplane to the left and right, attempting to knock the passengers off balance. At 9:58:57, Jarrah told another hijacker in the cockpit to block the door. Jarrah continued to roll the airplane sharply left and right, but the assault continued. At 9:59:52, Jarrah changed tactics and pitched the nose of the airplane up and down to disrupt the assault. The recorder captured the sounds of loud thumps, crashes, shouts, and breaking glasses and plates. At 10:03, Jarrah stabilized the airplane. 5 seconds later, Jarrah asked, "Is that it? Shall we finish it off?" A hijacker responded, "No, not yet. When they all come, we finish it off." The sounds of fighting continued outside the cockpit. Again, Jarrah pitched the nose of the aircraft up and down. At 10:26, a passenger in the background said, "In the cockpit. If we don't, we'll die." 16 seconds later, a passenger yelled, "Roll it." Jarrah stopped the violent maneuvers at about 10:01 and said, "Allah is the greatest. Allah is the greatest." He then asked another hijacker in the cockpit, "Is that it? I mean, shall we put it down?" To which the other replied, "Yes, put it in it and pull it down." The passengers continued their assault, and at 10:02:23, a hijacker said, "Pull it down, pull it down." The hijackers remained at the controls, but must have judged that the passengers were only seconds from overcoming them. The airplane headed down. The control wheel was turned hard to the right. The airplane rolled onto its back, and one of the hijackers began shouting, "Allah is the greatest! Allah is the greatest!" With the sounds of the passenger counterattack continuing, the aircraft plowed into an empty field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, at 580 miles per hour, about 20 minutes flying time from Washington, D.C. Jarrah's objective was to crash his airliner into symbols of the American Republic, the Capitol, or the White House. He was defeated by the alerted, unarmed passengers of United Flight 93. United Airlines Flight Number 93, FAA Awareness. At 9:27, after having been in the air for 45 minutes, United 93 acknowledged a transmission from the Cleveland Center controller. This was the last normal contact the FAA had with the flight. Less than a minute later, the Cleveland controller and the pilots of aircraft in the vicinity heard a radio transmission of unintelligible sounds of possible screaming or a struggle from an unknown origin. The controller responded seconds later, "Somebody call Cleveland." This was followed by a second radio transmission with sounds of screaming. The Cleveland Center controllers began to try to identify the possible source of the transmissions and noticed that United Flight Number 93 had descended some 700 feet. The controller attempted again to raise United 93 several times, with no response. At 9:30, the controller began to poll the other flights on his frequency to determine if they had heard the screaming. Several said they had. At 9:32, a third radio transmission came over the frequency. "Keep remaining sitting. We have a bomb on board." The controller understood, but chose to respond, "Calling Cleveland Center, you're unreadable. Say again, slowly." He notified his supervisor, who passed the notice up the chain of command. By 9:34, word of the hijacking had reached FAA headquarters. The FAA headquarters had by this time established an open line of communication with the command center at Herndon and instructed it to poll all its centers about suspect aircraft. The command center executed the request, and a minute later, Cleveland Center reported that United 93 may have a bomb on board. At 9:34, the command center relayed the information concerning United Flight No. 93 to FAA headquarters. At approximately 9:36, Cleveland advised the command center that it was still tracking United No. 93 and specifically inquired whether someone had requested the military to launch fighter aircraft to intercept the aircraft. Cleveland even told the command center it was prepared to contact a nearby military base to make the request. The command center told Cleveland that FAA personnel well above them in the chain of command had to make the decision to seek military assistance and were working on the issue. Between 9:34 and 9:38, the Cleveland controller observed United No. 93 climbing to 40,700 feet and immediately moved several aircraft out of its way. The controller continued to try to contact United No. 93 and asked whether the pilot could confirm that he had been hijacked. There was no response. Then, at 9:39, a fourth radio transmission was heard from United No. 93. Ziad Jarrah.
Hi, this is the captain. I would like to go to the main ship. We have home aboard and are going to back to the airport and have our demand, so please remain quiet.
The controller responded, United 93, understand you have a bomb on board. Go ahead. The flight did not respond. From 9:34 to 10:08, a command center facility manager provided frequent updates to Acting Deputy Administrator Monty Belger and other executives at FAA headquarters as United No. 93 headed toward Washington, D.C. At 9:41, Cleveland Center lost United No. 93's transponder signal. The controller located it on primary radar, matched its position with visual sightings from other aircraft, and tracked the flight as it turned east, then south. At 9:42, the command center learned from news reports that a plane had struck the Pentagon. The command center's national operations manager, Ben Sliney, ordered all FAA facilities to instruct all aircraft to land at the nearest airport. This was an unprecedented order. The air traffic control system handled it with great skill, as about 4,500 commercial and general aviation aircraft soon landed without incident. At 9:46, the command center updated FAA headquarters that United Flight No. 93 was now 29 minutes out of Washington, D.C., At 9:49, 13 minutes after Cleveland Center had asked about getting military help, the command center suggested that someone at headquarters should decide whether to request military assistance. FAA headquarters.
Hi, they're pulling Jeff away to talk about United 93.
Do we want to think about scrambling aircraft?
Oh, God, I don't know.
That's a decision somebody's going to have to make probably in the next 10 minutes.
Everybody just left the room.
At 9:53, FAA headquarters informed the command center that the deputy director for air traffic services was talking to Monty Belger about scrambling aircraft. Then the command center informed headquarters that controllers had lost track of United 93 over the Pittsburgh area. Within seconds, the command center received a visual report from another aircraft and informed headquarters that the aircraft was 20 miles northwest of Johnstown. United Flight No. 93 was spotted by another aircraft, and at 10:01, the command center advised FAA headquarters that one of the aircraft had seen United No. 93 waving his wings. The aircraft had witnessed the hijackers' efforts to defeat the passengers' counterattack. United number 93 crashed in Pennsylvania at 10:03:11, 125 miles from Washington, D.C. The precise crash time has been the subject of some dispute. The 10:03:11 impact time is supported by previous National Transportation Safety Board analysis and by evidence from the Commission staff's analysis of radar, the flight data recorder, the cockpit voice recorder, infrared satellite data, and air traffic control transmissions. 5 minutes later, the command center forwarded this update to headquarters. Command center.
Okay, there is now on the United 93.
Yes.
There is a report of black smoke in the last position I gave you, 15 miles south of Johnstown.
From the airplane or from the ground?
They're speculating it's from the aircraft.
Okay.
It hit the ground. That's what they're speculating. It's speculation only.
The aircraft that spotted the black smoke was the same unarmed Air National Guard cargo plane that had seen American 77 crash into the Pentagon 27 minutes earlier. It had resumed its flight to Minnesota and saw the smoke from the crash of United Flight No. 93 less than 2 minutes after the plane went down. At 10:17, the command center advised headquarters of its conclusion that United No. 93 had indeed crashed. Despite the discussions about military assistance, no one from FAA headquarters requested military assistance regarding United 93. Nor did any manager at FAA headquarters pass any of the information it had about United No. 93 to the military. Military Notification and Response. NEADS first received a call about United Flight No. 93 from the military liaison at Cleveland Center at 10:07. Unaware that the aircraft had already crashed, Cleveland passed to NEADS the aircraft's last known latitude and longitude. NEADS was never able to locate United No. 93 on radar because it was already in the ground. At the same time, the NEADS mission crew commander was dealing with the arrival of the Langley fighters over Washington, D.C., sorting out what their orders were with respect to potential targets. Shortly after 10:10, and having no knowledge either that United 93 had been heading toward Washington or that it had crashed, he explicitly instructed the Langley fighters, negative clearance to shoot aircraft over the nation's capital. The news of a reported bomb on board United 93 spread quickly at NEADS. The air defenders searched for United Flight 93's primary radar return and tried to locate other fighters to scramble. NEADS called Washington Center to report. NEADS.
Also want to give you heads up, Washington.
Go ahead.
United 93, have you got information on that yet?
Yeah, he's down.
He's down?
Yes.
When did he land? He did not land. Oh, he's down?
Yes,
down?
Somewhere up northeast of Camp David.
Northeast of Camp David.
That's the last report. They don't know exactly where.
The time of notification of the crash of United Flight No. 93 was 10:15. The NEADS air defenders never located the flight or followed it on their radar scopes. The flight had already crashed by the time they learned it was hijacked. Clarifying the record. The defense of U.S. airspace on 9/11 was not conducted in accord with pre-existing training and protocols. It was improvised by civilians who had never handled a hijacked aircraft that attempted to disappear, and by a military unprepared for the transformation of commercial aircraft into weapons of mass destruction. As it turned out, the NEADS air defenders had 9 minutes' notice on the first hijacked plane, no advance notice on the second, no advance notice on the third, and no advance notice on the fourth. We do not believe that the true picture of that morning reflects discredit on the operational personnel at NEADS or FAA facilities. NEAD's commanders and officers actively sought out information and made the best judgments they could on the basis of what they knew. Individual FAA controllers, facility managers, and command center managers thought outside the box in recommending a nationwide alert, in ground stopping local traffic, and ultimately in deciding to land all aircraft and executing that unprecedented order flawlessly. More than the actual events, inaccurate government accounts of those events made it appear that the military was notified in time to respond to two of the hijackings, raising questions about the adequacy of the response. Those accounts had the effect of deflecting questions about the military's capacity to obtain timely and accurate information from its own sources. In addition, they overstated the FAA's ability to provide the military with timely and useful information that morning. In public testimony before this commission in May 2003, NORAD officials stated that at 9:16, NEADS received hijack notification of United Flight 93 from the FAA. This statement was incorrect. There was no hijack to report at 9:16. United Flight Number 93 was proceeding normally at that time. In this same public testimony, NORAD officials stated that at 9:24, NEADS received notification of the hijacking of American Flight Number 77. This statement was also incorrect. The notice NEADS received at 9:24 was that American Flight Number 11 had not hit the World Trade Center and was heading for Washington, D.C. In their testimony and in other public accounts, NORAD officials also stated that the Langley fighters were scrambled to respond to the notifications about American Flight Number 77, United Flight Number 93, or both. These statements were incorrect as well. The fighters were scrambled because of the report that American Flight Number 11 was heading south, as is clear not just from taped conversations at NEADS, but also from taped conversations at FAA centers. Contemporaneous logs compiled at NEADS, Continental Region Headquarters, and NORAD, and other records. Yet this response to a phantom aircraft was not recounted in a single public timeline or statement issued by the FAA or Department of Defense. The inaccurate accounts created the impression that the Langley scramble was a logical response to an actual hijacked aircraft. In fact, not only was the scramble prompted by the mistaken information about American Flight Number 11, but NEADS never received notice that American Flight Number 77 was hijacked. It was notified at 9:34 that American Number 77 was lost. Then, minutes later, NEADS was told that an unknown plane was 6 miles southwest of the White House. Only then did the already scrambled airplanes start moving directly toward Washington, D.C. Thus, the military did not have 14 minutes to respond to American Flight Number 77, as testimony to the commission in May 2003 suggested. It had, at most, 1 or 2 minutes to react to the unidentified plane approaching Washington, and the fighters were in the wrong place to be able to help. They had been responding to a report about an aircraft that did not exist. Nor did the military have 47 minutes to respond to United Flight Number 93, as would be implied by the account that it received notice of the flight's hijacking at 9:16. By the time the military learned about the flight, it had crashed.